The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. some gadget guy, the SGG of this terribly named and a couple minutes late podcast this week. Restream changed their entire web front end. So I'm getting everything set up, got my coffee, go downstairs, get some water. You know, it's a couple minutes. I should probably log in, change the title, make sure everything's all set up. Everything's different. Everything's different. So it took me an additional, 3 minutes to find the button, what does the thing that turns on all the stuff. And I appreciate everybody hanging out there, because I still need that 5 minutes. You know, I always have that intro, and that's kind of where I share, it's where I tweet out, so I post it on the YouTubes. So, yeah, thanks everybody for hanging in there. We're already starting this week off on the left foot. That's exactly where we're at. I'm seeing an incredible group already in the chat right now. Gary the Fireman, Simon Says Hypno, Gormlord, Dave Burns, Copycash, Matt Tyler, Mr. Malignant, Ray Mondit, I'm Tech Lovin' Mama is already in here, Gabaletta, ER1980, I'm missing people. If I haven't said your name, I apologize for not being very good. Streamy Boys just said, hiya! Simon Says Hypno, I have to say the makeup job is immaculate. Well, thank you. Well, I've been working on it. Actually, I do need to kind of refresh my makeup game. Whenever I have you can kind of see right now, I've got like a little flare up happening on my face. I was for a while, especially when I was on Newegg, because we had all the studio lighting and the soft boxes, my touch up game was real good. I knew like what foundations to use with what highlights and kind of dab in there, just kind of touch up, kind of clear things up. I was looking real good on Newegg. So I've got a reset here. It's funny, you know, like the differences in lighting and camera and it's all a mess, but I could probably do with a refresher. I haven't really done stage makeup well in a really long time. Matt Tyler, that's 5 minutes off housekeeping. It's still going to take me some time there. And TK Bay, everyone say sabajo to TK Bay. Matt Tyler, I'm going to have to hire Juan's makeup guy. Well, I will fly out there and I will help you with your makeup. And I can't guarantee that it's going to be good. So, because I am running a couple minutes late, I'm gonna front load this. Gadget block this week is really incomplete. I put out a call on Twitter just if there are any stories that people want to talk about or anything that you want to follow up on. I feel like the Galaxy Note 22 is probably something we can chat out prior to Samsung's official reveal. We've got some leaks and rumors there, but if we get to the gadget block and that's all we really have to talk about, we can definitely turn that into a bit more of a Q&A if there's anything that you want to chat out. I'm wrapping up some time with the Z Fold 3. TK still has my Duo, and I want my Duo back. And I've been playing with a few other kind of interesting phones. When I showed off like that stack of phones a while back, I have way too many phones on my desk and over on my table. So NVIDIA followed my point. That was great. There's been a lot going on. So, yeah. If we want to turn it into more of a casual chat Q&A, we absolutely can. But I am going to try and focus on... Excuse me. I'm going to try and focus on getting this podcast, keeping it to around 2 hours, because I like the flow of the show when we're really moving, and I'm not just rambling on about the politics. Aw, AJ USA or Ajusa? I'm not sure how to say your name, but this is your first chat, and flattery will get you everywhere. Writing, I thought this guy was in his mid-20s when I saw a 10-year-old video where he looks the exact same. Woohoo! I win! No, I'm old and tired and cranky. I'm the guy that's, like, now telling new tech YouTubers to get off my lawn. So Tech Love and Mom, when I talk about makeup, I'm talking about a very specific practical application of stage and television makeup. Also like when I would do those Fox TV appearances, their makeup woman was incredible. I was in the middle of like the worst, like half face. I looked like Two-Face, but I had this huge spread of splotchy psoriasis scarring, and she made me look perfectly symmetrical. Blew my mind. And ever since then, I've been trying to like find little ways that I can kind of just even things out or touch things up so it's not glaringly distracting. But Tech Loving Mama saying, makeup makes mine look worse more often than not, so I don't wear foundation. The last time I did was a wedding 2 years ago. So yeah, I don't go out. It's not like I'm using makeup to touch up like daily life. Completely different style. Like when I'm talking about makeup, it's because I've got like hard light, side light, and I know the camera is going to be facing me. So as long as I can just touch up this part of my nose, then everything's great. You know, it's like, it's a completely, if I had to wear makeup as just like my natural expression of my own personal style, oh man, that'd not be a good look right now. Oh, and Chris is awake to actually catch the podcast. Welcome, Chris. We've got Streamy Boy saying some ageless guy. You guys are just like, gonna make me blushy and stuff. I love this. All right. Okay. Oh, and Simon says Hypno. Absolutely true. 4K TV causes makeup on presenters to look like Simpsons characters. Again, they're you've got to like... You've got to find a whole new... It's the same thing with movies. You know, makeup effects, you know, prosthetics and things, hair pieces. When you've got so much more clarity going into the digital representation of a performer captured under specific lighting, I feel like an entire older generation of filmmakers don't understand. Or also what happened with, like, Peter Jackson, you know, when he was doing the Hobbit films and trying to do them in high frame rate. Well, that increases clarity and reduces motion blur. And boy, your special effects and your makeup effects don't look as good when there's extra clarity to scrutinize. So, yeah. So what, Ben Affleck's hairpiece. Oh, no. Sorry, that was Gary the Fireman. all right, why don't we knock out some housekeeping and then we can kind of make it, we can kind of get through the news block and we can go from there. Here, let me get this out of the way here. Everything that we're going to be talking about, show notes, links, all that fun stuff, you're going to be able to find on the on my website, my web zone, the web page of me, somegadgetguy.com. Let me get this here and get this back here. Okay, so last week I got a lot of stuff prepped, so I feel like more videos are going to be coming out this week, but I did get a couple little shorts out. I'm not going to, you know, spend a bunch of time on those, but I did get an article out and a video out that I felt, you know, pretty good stuff. So, there we go. So the, oh man, did I not format this? Hold on, let me just make sure. No, that looks good. That looks, actually, you know what? Let me scroll it out a little bit more. There we go. Man, I'm just off my intro this week. David, ew, shorts. I'm playing the algorithm game. We'll see if it's worth anything. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of the shorts. Anyway, I wrote up a review. I love the Rode Wireless Go 2 microphones. Dave Burns is using the Rode Wireless Go 2 on his Twitch streams, especially when he's co-streaming, because they're so easy to get like an interview or a two-channel setup on these little wireless mics. They're super, super handy. But one of the things you might want to consider when you have rechargeable batteries in a wireless mic is how do you keep them powered out in the field? And the company ZG Sina, sent over a charge case. So it's a hard protective case that you can plug the mics into and you can charge the entire system while you're out in the field. And I thought that was kind of fun. Streamy boys, your shorts are informative though. Well, thank you. I'm trying to play with them. I'm trying to do them my way, which of course means like they're probably not going to be very popular. And then the major video that I put out last week, Surface Duo 2, Can We Fix This Camera? I did an almost 30-minute camera deep dive on the Surface Duo 2. Finally got, like, well, first of all, we finally got a major update. I finally had the time to shoot with it. The camera sensors are definitely last generation style sensors, but they're very good versions of last generation sensors. And I really struggled. I ultimately failed to come to a packaged conclusion of, are these cameras worth the change in the Duo's form factor? And so as an adjunct to that, the camera deep dives are increasingly just going to be the Patreon exclusives. And really with the work on my plate right now, I'm going to be doing less and less of cutting them up to make shorter form public videos. But there was a public part of this conversation that I wanted to kind of chat about, where maybe there is a solution that we can revisit that might fix the Duo form factor. So I've got my Duo 1, and one of my favorite things about it is that it can go all the way flat screen out, and then I can just keep this in my pocket like a single screen phone. And I don't have to worry about a camera bulge creating a big old gap or extra pressure on that camera module whenever it's all the way screen out. So if we could retain this form factor, what could we do about the camera situation? And that's what that video is trying to address. Now, the only reason why I'm spending a little time kind of setting this up and talking about it is for a crew of tech enthusiasts, the people in this chat, I feel, understand the physics at play. Because you've heard me ramble on about how much I like the Duo and what I like about the Duo form factor. So you're well educated here. But I put this video out there and I got some great, like, people engaged responses, like, well, what if we did this? Or how about a periscoping camera sensor? What if it flipped out like on an Asus? And it was shocking to me, like, people who are engaged with tech channels had no concept or no idea of just how incredibly radically thin the Duo really is in the hand. When that's like the main talking point, especially from the first generation Duo, where Microsoft played all of those massive channels, like just worked them over hard. You're allowed to talk about how thin it is and you're allowed to talk about the hinge. So drop the Duo on my keyboard. Nothing to see here. Actually, let me make sure I didn't just crack my USB. No, it's fine. Okay, it's fine. Caught it on the first bounce. for how radically thin the Duo is, there are so many of these, well, they should just make the cameras flush. And you're like, well, that would require making the phone thicker than any current smartphone. Just no understanding. And again, it kind of drives home to me, you've got a whole crew of tech enthusiasts out there that love to hear other people just read the specs and then complain about the price. Because this is a phenomenal feat of radical engineering. And it's like I'm running out of ways to describe in a meaningful way how thin it is. It's literally two-thirds the depth of an iPhone SE. And conceptualizing that seems to be really difficult for a lot of people. So someone was saying, like, well, why can't it just have pop-out camera sensors? And so I pulled out my OnePlus 7 Pro. Whoops. And I just knocked over one of my transmitters. Hopefully that didn't mess up my audio. I pull out my OnePlus 7 Pro, and the OnePlus 7 Pro has a pop-out selfie camera, and the Duo is thinner than the pop-out selfie camera. So where would you put the motors to have a flip-out camera or a flush camera sensor? It can't exist in this form factor. And it was great because, like, we even had Septian reply, like, whoa, I didn't know the OnePlus 7 Pro was so thick. And you're like, no, you're missing the point. The OnePlus 7 Pro is incredibly thin for having motors inside of it that pop out a selfie camera. What we're describing is that the Duo is even more remarkably, shockingly thinner than that. So this video at least kind of spurred that kind of fun conversation about what this tech really looks like. But it did make me sad because there were a whole bunch of people out there that had strong opinions on form factors and folding phones, and they had no concept of what the Duo really was. So they're still like, oh, but I mean, it's just like a fold, but not as good. And you're like, no, it's different. And until you hold one and use one, you can't be prepared for how different it is. Well, just put moving parts on it. But where would they go? It was the same thing. I got into that chat with Jay Will. Like, they should have just made all the cameras flush. Where would you find the lenses to do that? Well, how do you know they can't? Well, because basic physics? Physics is hard, Kappa Cash. Physics is hard. So, yeah, Simon says, Hypno is saying, I think Microsoft's only recourse is a thicker body, and I disagree. I disagree, good sir. I disagree. So, I don't know why I got so aggressive. I actually would want them to return to the even thinner, because the Duo 2 is ever so slightly just a little bit thicker per panel, but it's still insanely thin. I would actually want them to return to this if there was a way to spread out some of the internals to still find the battery capacity advantage. But my video expresses what I think would be a better solution for the Surface lineup of products in general. And you can catch that video on somegadgetguide.com. Surface Duo 2, can we fix the camera? And it's a really great video that I put together that I'm not going to just do the whole thing and talk about it all here. Ted Talks Tech, a little thickness never hurt anyone, Juan. True, but that we already have the fold for that. If I want a big lump of two phones of thickness in my pocket, I can go and get a fold. See, I don't want that. I want thin, and especially for thin being a perfect little book form factor with beautiful hinges that don't snap the unit closed and require additional force to open. It's just so accessible and easy to use. And it's so great for the multitasking lifestyle that I've come to appreciate about Android. And that's what I want. I want Duo 1 form factor back. I want to go thinner. I'll sacrifice some of the battery to get thinner. I'll do it. Just watch me. Take that to the bank. Because I know you won't. Oh, Tech Loving Mama, I can't put that comment up. But I feel we'll all get a chuckle out of that. So, I'm going to go ahead and cap it on housekeeping there. TK and I did a stream on Thursday. I put out another video for reviews.org. It was a pretty jam-packed week, and we've got some other fun things coming up, some fun gadgets to talk about. So why don't we jump into the news block? Let's chew through some of these news stories, get them out of the way, especially because, like, housekeeping, I got that done in a reasonably short period of time. News block is a little heavier. We've got some things that we've got to dig into, just topics that we need to also revisit. Just keep an eye on the flow of how some of this tech story is sort of evolving in front of us. And then, like I said, if you've got questions, comments, concerns, or just stuff that you want to chat about, someone hit me up on Twitter and was like, hey, do you think this would work? And we can save that for the gadget block in the second half. So, this is a family show. Okay. Yeah, apparently there is a whole side conversation happening right now. All right. Let's get the politics out of the way first, because this is absolutely something we need to be keeping an eye on. And outside of the tech community, we know that it's going to be very poorly covered in the mainstream media. So there's a committee bill trying to reform the major tech corporations. This is from Engadget, written up by A. Tarantola. Senator Klobuchar's major tech reform bill advances out of committee. Let's see. So a major tech reform bill that would prevent the industry's biggest players, Apple, Amazon, Google, and their ilk, from discriminating against smaller businesses that rely on the big platform services, is one step closer to passage on Thursday after passing from committee on a bipartisan 16-6 vote. Senators Mike Lee, John Cornyn, Ben Sasse, Tom Cotton, Tom Tillis, and Marsha Blackburn all voted against it. So we're looking for the American Innovation and Choice Online Act, which is, you should try to read through the bill. And I'm a little confused about the application of this bill and what the enforcement of this bill will be. But essentially, what it's trying to do is prevent a platform from prioritizing its own apps, services, or products if it also competes against other players using that platform. An example would be Amazon Basics. So Amazon, they watch other smaller sellers on their platform. For example, we went through this with, I don't know where my camera sling is. Yeah, with Peak Design. This is literally the product that actually created some of this conversation. This is my Peak Design sling. This is one of my all-time favorite camera bags. I love shoulder slings. You know, it's great, especially because I use Micro Four Thirds cameras, so it's real easy to have like an entire day's worth of lenses and two camera bodies in a very simple shoulder sling. Beautifully constructed. This podcast, not sponsored by Peak Design, but I absolutely love their products. And so Amazon can look at the sort of seller interactions from one of the people using their platform, and then they can kind of copycat not only just the product itself, but then also other aspects of how the product is marketed, is advertised, how the reviews work, everything, because Amazon is privy to all of that data. So that to me is something that's a little anti-competitive, and there is no consistent regulatory policy on how to do that. So what Peak Design would have to do is engage in legal conflict with one of the world's largest mega corporations and data brokers, and then figure out, like, hey, is this like a trademarking kind of thing? Is it a copyright? Did we have a patent on anything? And they'd have to enforce it. They'd actually have to try and defend their intellectual property in a court of law against one of the most well-funded teams of lawyers on the planet. So what this bill is aiming to do is provide some basic framework where Amazon, the umbrella corporation, versus Amazon, the platform, versus Amazon, the maker of products, would have to kind of keep some separation between those various business entities. And I don't know that that's practically possible, But if we don't start somewhere to try and enforce a more competitive landscape, then the only recourse companies are going to have is, hey, we started this company, we created a cool product. The only thing we have left to do is get bought by Google or Apple or Microsoft or someone else. And that, to me, doesn't speak of a healthy capitalistic marketplace. That, to me, speaks of, you know, warring monopoly factions sort of grinding consumers under their boot. I don't know where that visual imagery just came from. So, something to keep an eye on. When last week we were hearing reports of people going to DC and lobbying pretty hard, one of the major individuals, one of the highest profile individuals to show up in DC and really lobby against this type of regulatory action was, of course, Mr. Tim Cook. Apple was very interested in not letting or not wanting the government to have any interaction or say in what was going on with digital marketplaces and app stores and how Apple can kind of look at a competitor's business model and then copy it completely for themselves and then leverage their entire infrastructure of consumers to fight, you know, a competing entity that only has a more limited, product offering. So I don't think that this was too surprising. Their big argument, and I should sort of clarify this, what I'm showing on the screen right now is from CNBC, written up by Lauren Feiner and Kif Leswing. Apple says antitrust bill could cause millions of Americans to suffer malware attacks. And again, it's the FUD. This notion that Apple being forced to open the gates on an app store or allow for alternative purchasing options, which they're already having to do in other countries. They're just fighting it the hardest here. No big surprise. I kind of feel like if your product is that poorly made and your service is not that competitive, that if you were to just allow for the ability to sideload programs on the iPhone, well, that's the market speaking, isn't it? We want an open market. And if the app store isn't good enough to keep their customers just using the app store, then I feel that's capitalism. That's competition. I mean, that means Apple just needs to make a better product. If they made a good enough product, then they wouldn't need to worry about people trying to leave the app store. If they made a good enough app store, they wouldn't have to worry about developers wanting to sell directly to consumers or using alternative purchasing solutions. So really, I just don't understand. If Apple is really this bad at making services and making an ecosystem, they're probably overdue a market correction. I'm just saying. And CoffeeCash again, there they go again, playing the privacy game. Because it almost sounds like a threat now, right? If you make us open up the app store or let people sideload apps on the iPhone, it's going to be bad. Sure would be a shame if your iPhone started leaking all your browser data. The iPhones already do that. They still do that. Yeah. Yeah, we covered that last week. Your iPhone is the least secure it's ever been right now. Paul has taken this PG-13 in the chat. When I use my iPhone, my privates don't seem any more secure. it's pretty great. So you'll have to say, is it AJUSA or is it AJUSA? This is absolutely a concern. The main issue with alternative app stores, which plagues Android as well, is that it can lead to convenient piracy. So sideloading apps and sideloading services, there is a market of
of bad actors out there that love to crack open apps for Android devices and sort of repackage the APK so you can get around copy protection. It's one of the reasons why I feel so many services on Android phones immediately go to a subscription model. This is one of the ways that they can kind of better safeguard updates and create a constant sort of check-in with the app, the phone, and then the Google Play Store. But on top of that, I would also be curious to see what is the ramification of that piracy in the larger context of how many consumers are able to use it. You know, the ability to activate sideloading on an Android phone is a multi-step process in the settings. And is it being taken advantage of? I honestly don't have data. And I've tried, especially after these stories came out, I tried searching, like, what are the number of installs versus? But when we look at competition, one of the reasons why I keep pointing to this, the idea of having a competing app store, and it's on the app store to kind of verify, like, hey, if someone's ripping off someone else's content and I'm hosting it on my app store, it, you know, I am legally liable for someone else to come after me with a DMCA notice or a takedown request. But what I hope to see is, you know, like a games market hosted by NVIDIA, right? What I hope to see is another competing app store for alternative AOSP products, you know, Android operating system products that aren't Googleified. And I would say, you know, sort of the continued existence of Fire tablets is a good example of that. And I feel like there's sort of a good competition point that keeps Google innovating for the Google Play Store, where Apple doesn't have any pressure to make their products or services better. That's what I want to see. Google needs to earn my patronage, and they need to earn it by improving services, improving products, improving compatibility. And the only pressure they're going to get is from outside the Google Play Store. So I absolutely agree with you. Piracy is a concern, but to me, it's one that we solve along the way while we improve the competition. And improving the competition also means we're doing things like fighting for developers to make sure that their products are safe and that their purchasing is secured and that their relationship with consumers is maintained. That's a smaller part of that larger conversation. Absolutely appreciate the comment. That was very well put. Ted Talks Tech. Should be a shame if your devices became less secure. Well, I mean, and Ted here is really concerned because there's a new update out for his Mac, and I don't know that he's done it. So I thought Apple did the bestest software, Ted. Any concerns? I mean, you pushed go on that Mac update, right? Everything's great whenever Apple puts out software. I mean, it's not like Google, where a Pixel device is so garbage you should send it back and they should do a recall because your webcam video can sometimes be a little grainy. Apple, it just works. Oh, Ajusa. Okay, cool. Thanks. AJUSA is not the way.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
See, and Gabaletta, again, this is kind of what I'm driving at here. This is a great comment too. I feel like Samsung tried to rip off the Google Play Store with their own app store that often doesn't have the most updated version of the app, or it has its own version of the app from the developer for Galaxy phones that often don't get updated as well as the ones on the Play Store. And that to me is precisely why I don't use Samsung's app store, but I have to have it if I ever want to pair a Galaxy Watch, you know, especially an older Galaxy Watch with one of my Galaxy phones. So it's like that to me speaks to what is the perception of that product? What is the consumer relationship and has it improved? So I feel iPhones would get better. There was a way to sideload, and I feel it would force Apple to reconsider their relationships with developers and their relationships with their consumers. And it might be bad for a couple fiscal quarters for Apple, but this is also part of that highly disingenuous way that Apple talks about their products and services and looking out for their customers and their developers, and we don't engage in bullying and it's not a part of our corporate culture. We can't even tell you under oath how much money the App Store brings in, because we just don't even think of it that way, man. We just don't. But they're so viscerally opposed to any kind of regulatory oversight on their business model here. And they send their CEO to Washington, D.C. to lobby lawmakers directly. But, you know, we just don't even know. I mean, does the App Store even make money? We just do it for the feels, man. I mean, that's what they said under oath during the Epic lawsuit, right? That's ridiculous. Like, if I were investing in a company and the CEO or CFO or one of the chief technology officers, one of the high-level executives ever said, yeah, we just don't even know, I would immediately sell that stock. I would immediately get out of business with that company, because it's either a lie and they're lying under oath, or if it's the truth, that's even worse. So that's the game with Apple right now. Dave Burns. Apple, we don't bully. WordPress has entered the chat. The WordPress situation, again, if you ever needed data on how contentious and punitive the relationship is between Apple and their developers, that is the perfect case study. What went down with WordPress, I'm not going to repeat it here. Go look it up. Please do so. That's who you're doing business with when you're doing business with Apple. And it's really sad. And you see, Google can't quite get away with the same level of toxic punitive. They can get close, but they can't quite completely crush a developer the way that Apple can, because that developer does have the recourse of taking their app out of the Google Play Store and just making the push that you'll load it directly through an APK. You know, that's what we get with more control over our products and better relationships with the companies that we do business with. Yeah. It's a good read. Oh, and if you just want to get that like righteous indignation going, it's WordPress really lights it up. So one of the reasons why I wanted to start with that, that's the politics. Sorry, I did ramble on a bit more about the politics than I wanted to. But I wanted to start with that to kind of also segue into a conversation about Android and gaming. I love mobile gaming, and especially over the last 2 years, we've seen a number of titles come to Android as PC ports, console ports, last generation games. Mobile gaming is becoming this healthy place to find the last life of a game in a way where a couple accessories can really make an almost portable console-grade experience. And that's before you get into things like emulation. I'm really trying to support the developers that are working for Android directly. Like, they're really trying to put their best foot forward. When you play a game like Dead Cells, and it runs incredibly well on mid-ranger phones, like, that's the kind of developer I want to support, because they're not just slapping their phone on Android and it's a mess. Like, they actually took the time to port that game properly to another platform that was absolutely on the bottom of the list. Like, for a developer trying to make a game like Dead Cells, any indie game, but I'm pointing to Dead Cells because I think they're one of the successes in this field. And just recently, I did rebuy Alien Isolation again, because the actual PC version of Alien Isolation is now on Android, and it's a huge game. It's like 20 gig on your phone, but it's real good, and it plays real good. So there's this push, and we're seeing from Qualcomm, one of the major initiatives they're going to be getting after is mobile gaming. They're working with NVIDIA to make like a, or working with Razer, sorry, working with Razer to make like a prototype portable handheld Switch-like gaming machine, but using Qualcomm SoCs. It's good times. So it makes me kind of sad when we're starting to see these little glimmers of interest. Developers are starting to take this more seriously. And Google, I last year was talking about bringing Android games to Windows PCs. Well, that's live, but only in a couple countries. So there's a beta for Google Play Games, and it's not available in my country. And that makes me really sad because it's, again, it's more evidence that the United States just matters less and less as the place to launch new tech. So a couple, mostly in Asian countries, but I've signed up to get notified. I really like this idea. It's the idea where you can start playing a game on your phone, move it to a PC, working with developers to improve on controls. So like, you play it on a touchscreen and then move to a controller, or you want to switch to a keyboard and mouse. This is good for every platform, but it's kind of a bummer where I don't get to play with it, and I've been wanting exactly this. That's all I really had to say about the setup here. It's kind of a bummer. McCorkran, that is actually a fair point. That's maybe something we can talk about during the gadget block. I'm afraid Samsung is going to gobble up all the chips, nom, 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 and the gaming phones will be increasingly hard to get. So like a impact on ROGs and Black Sharks, Red Magics. I don't know if Lenovo is going to do another Legion. It's going to get rough. I mean, it really is, and especially with some of the launch teething pains. I'm very anxious about the Exynos. We talked about that last week too, and immediately after I talked about it, Samsung was like, no, it's totally coming out. So I guess Samsung was really concerned about the impact of my podcast. We got a couple more news stories here. I just want to wrap up real quick. I can't do justice because I'm not a network radio management specialist, but on Reuters, There's a story going live, and obviously this has been picked up by a number of other outlets. Reuters, written up by David Shepherdson, major U.S. airlines warn 5G could ground planes wreak havoc. So from the article, the chief executives of major U.S. passenger and cargo carriers on Monday warned of an impending, quote, catastrophic, end quote, aviation crisis in less than 36 hours, when AT&T and Verizon are set to deploy new 5G service. The airlines warned the new C-band 5G service set to begin on Wednesday could render a significant number of wide-body aircraft unusable, quote, could potentially strand tens of thousands of Americans overseas and cause chaos for U.S. flights. So I don't know how we got to this point. I know that the rollout for 5G has been aggressive, has been like they're trying to push this tech. I mean, especially from like 2019 to now, that rollout at once feels like it's been really slow, like waiting for cities to light up the little 5G icon on your phone. But at the other hand, has also been incredibly quick for how many phones started adopting 5G radios, especially sub-6. 5G. So in that main push, where the carriers are supposed to do their due diligence in what kinds of conflicts this technology might create with other established communications protocols, to then get to this point where representatives of airlines are saying we're going to have to ground flights, just seems to me like an overly abbreviated process for how this technology was certified. And again, it's where we maybe need to better empower the FCC, and where we also need to look at, like, what is it about our infrastructure, especially here in the United States, where these types of conflicts can arise because of how we let corporations dictate the technologies they're going to use, and how that creates kind of an anti-competitive marketplace for consumers and also harms other institutions like airlines. Again, it's just this overlapping tapestry of seemingly bad corporate decisions and not doing enough work on verifying the tech and not having a regulatory agency that can act on behalf of airlines. I know that just really freaks me out. There are reasons why we have these kinds of institutions in place. It's pretty rough. My mom was asking me about the 5G airline issue the other day. She lives a couple of miles from a small airport and wondered if she might be impacted. Matt Tyler. See, Matt Tyler has sort of firsthand experience in this because, like, they were burning 5G towers in the UK. If 5G gives a plane COVID, does that mean that plane is now a transport for 5G radiation that kills? Because I won't be flying if the plane breathes on me. From JMX Warrior, but the frequencies are completely different blocks for 5G and for airplanes. And that's why I can't comment directly on some of these claims, is because I don't fully understand. So just because the frequencies are different doesn't mean that you can't encounter significant interference. My practical example of that is taking 2.4 gig wireless microphones into convention spaces. My Samsung 2.4 gig wireless lav does not operate at the exact same frequencies as Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. Products like that have to go through an FCC certification that they're not overlapping with other kinds of telecommunications equipment. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if the frequencies are a little bit different. I go into that convention space and I'm saturated by Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, and those mics don't work for ish at all. So that to me becomes the anecdotal data point that I use in my brain to kind of understand other frequency conflicts, other communications conflicts, and potentially what might be an issue here when we're talking about C-band. I don't know, though. I can't explain better than that. Moving right along, let's go ahead and wrap up. Two more. We'll spend the last 10 minutes talking about something a little bit heavier. I just wanted to highlight this as yet another project that Google lost interest in. John Fingus over at Engadget: YouTube mostly abandons its original content ambitions. It's refocusing on Black voices, shorts, and shopping. So yeah, YouTube is increasingly looking to turn YouTube into a portal through which commerce can happen, which no one wants. I mean, I try to link products and I do a lot of gadget reviews, and obviously I link affiliate links, but I don't know, just the relationship directly between Google and manufacturers and myself, I don't know that this is really the shopping destination that I'm looking for. But it did make me kind of sad because YouTube Originals were an interesting idea. You know, like Google was looking at turning YouTube into more of a Netflix competitor back in the day. Now they've lost interest in that and they're trying to turn YouTube into a TikTok competitor. Instead of just making YouTube YouTube, they're trying to make YouTube anything else. Again, I've been dabbling with shorts. Don't much care for them. I don't think in 60-second snippets. It's not how I like to create or interact with content. Obviously, I do a two-hour podcast every week. But one of the things that I wanted to just sort of say my RIP here for YouTube Originals is because without without this initiative, we never would have gotten Cobra Kai. And I don't know if anyone here has finished the most recent season of Cobra Kai, but it's damn fun. It's cornball to the extreme. It's soap opera ridiculous. It's melodrama. Chef kiss at its finest, and I love it, and I need as many seasons of the LaRussos as I can get, because it's fantastic. The most recent ending, oh boy, no spoilers, it's wonderful, and I absolutely adore the show's commitment to sort of investigating the lives of characters from the movies. So they bring in cast members from Karate Kid 2. This most recent season revolves around a character from Karate Kid 3. It's glorious how many callbacks and references, but it's not dependent on it. You know, it's like they explain enough just to let you know this character relates to this character and that's how that works. You don't need to have seen the movies to understand what's going down. But if you have seen the movies, you're rewarded for having that kind of come back. I mean, it's just really, truly wonderful. It kind of reminds me a little of the first season of The Flash on the CW network, where they would bring in character actors from the original Flash television show. It's that kind of labor of love. Like, you know that the people writing the show got in deep on Karate Kid lore. So good. So, YouTube Originals, thank you at least for having given us, given the world Cobra Kai. I'll remember the initiative fondly as we all make fun of Google for killing yet another product of theirs. Juan started talking about Cobra Kai and I threw my phone across the room. No spoilers. And Dustin Dore, I mean, again, we're talking about Cobra Kai and it is such hilarious soap opera fodder, but it works. I completely agree. Not just their lives, but also how the current culture has influenced their ways of moving through the world now as versus how they did in the 80s. Cobra Kai is a good time. It's so good. Oh, man, it's so good. Yeah, that's good. So, want to wrap up the news block. This is a video that kind of took the online community by storm. I'm not going to do a very good job of summing it all up because it's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And really, I want you to watch every minute of it. But this was shared on our Discord. A number of people hit me up in DMs sharing this too. Dave Burns put it up on one of our channels. This is Folding Ideas. Well, first of all, that's terrible. I need to subscribe. Folding Ideas makes these really brilliant sort of quasi-documentary videos covering a variety of different topics. If you haven't seen their video on flat earthers and QAnon, that is incredible content. And they make really savvy, hip-looking videos that are very well-researched and easy to kind of understand the flow of what's going on in those conversations. Dave Burns, line goes up. To the moon, everybody. We're going to the moon. This video, The Problem with NFTs. Something I've talked about on the podcast. This is a brilliantly researched and argued piece of content describing the many issues with cryptocurrency, with the consolidation of wealth, with the lack of regulation, and with a market that's so speculative that it seems to exist almost entirely to create safer platforms for traditional money scams. If it's like a multi-level marketing or a pyramid scheme, if it's a pump and dump, if it's any other type of thing that we've tried to control the stock market to get rid of that sort of corruption, there are some incredible arguments here for how cryptocurrency is the next step in a cat and mouse game trying to revive all of those money scams from older generations of investors. So definitely give this a watch. I would just like to point out, this video was published January 21st. I mean, it's not nearly as comprehensive and it doesn't come to as dire a conclusion, but there was this really cute little video on reviews.org, NFTs, buyer beware, where they break down some of the problems with the current implementation of blockchain technology. And they also talk about like an example of what a potential scam might look like for an NFT or, you know, link rot, you know, those types of situations. It's not as good. This video is not as good, but this video is only 7 minutes long versus 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I just thought reviews.org did a really good job of kind of condensing some of those ideas into an easily digestible conversation. And that video came out 10 days before the Folding Ideas video. So they were even more on the pulse. Oh, Dave Burns is giving me the nice little pat on the head. Yeah, that one was also really informative. Pat, 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 pat. Oh, yeah. Gormlord, me too. I'm just excited to take a trip to crypto land. As we're watching prices on GPUs start to fall, maybe this kind of backlash. I think the Folding Ideas video is helping inform some of the market corrections we've seen, like Bitcoin dropped, Ethereum dropped. I am so positive on this tech, but I don't think we've figured out what to use it for, because I don't think it makes for a good currency, and it currently is not a good solution for artists and content creators for selling their products. Like, a traditional photography contract is going to be a much better operational agreement between an artist and a patron than this, what we've created for NFTs. And I just can't quite, you know, again, if I could, I would be an immensely more wealthy individual, but I can't wrap my brain. What we do with the blockchain could be revolutionary, but I don't know what it's good for yet. And I don't think we figured that out. And unfortunately, I think the course of the blockchain is being guided by people with extremely selfish self-interests in their own profitability, not creating what Web3 could be with this interconnected public chain of data. I'm just morbidly fascinated with what it might turn into. Just what we do with it today, I think, is incredibly inappropriate for what the technology might represent later. And even if it's something far more mundane, it could be something really interesting. I'm rambling now, and I'm kind of stumbling over my ideas because I can't properly quantify what I think it could be. I'm not enough of a futurist to kind of stick that landing. Well, no, so Ajusa, this is what I mean. So Ajusa writes, the problem with the blockchain is that it is slower and worse than a centralized system, except for the fact that it is decentralized. But power can be very easily centralized on a blockchain, and it takes a lot more energy to run a number of alterations to the blockchain. And there can be conflicts with the blockchain, as we saw with Ethereum, how that got forked. I mean, there's so many moving parts to this. What we're currently using it for is a real bad fit for a digital public register of activity. I don't think that's good for a currency, and I don't think it's good for a marketplace. So what else could we do with it? And that's what gets me kind of lit up. If we're going to put this much literal energy into creating an online register, what else, where else can it go? And that's where I think we'll actually find the next phase of interactions online. We're absolutely not there yet. Hashtag some blockchain guy. All right, well, that's going to wrap us up for the news block. We want to cover a quick subreddit plug, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. This is a community built to help promote other content creators. The main mission is you want to share content that you feel deserves more attention. I absolutely dominated the subreddit last week. A number one top story on Glowing Rectangles. It's not even a video. It's an article written by morethanjustaphone.wordpress.com. Do you need the latest, greatest, most powerful smartphone? Top voted. An editorial just talking about what our needs are versus our wants. I just thought this was a nice way to kind of shake up some of the content that we traditionally get. My Surface Duo 2 video came in the second place, and then my Z Fold 3 versus Pixel 6 Pro versus OnePlus 9 Pro camera launch showdown short also rounded out the top three. We've got an article from Omar Zahran. Sorry, I just mispronounced your name. Is it time for Apple to embrace RCS in the fourth place? And rounding out the top five, Sneed, Mobile, Tech, AT&T launching HyperGig. What is it? New simplified pricing plan tiers. Some really good market analysis from Sneed, Mobile, Tech. And those are top five videos on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And I'll go ahead and spoil my short. If you have a Samsung phone, you've got the slowest. I know a number of YouTubers out there were really concerned. Like on the Pixel 6, they didn't have any data to back it up and they couldn't show it or demonstrate it. But, you know, I just felt like as they were using the camera, they would launch the camera. It just seemed to be slower. And that's why they went back to a Samsung. And if you really put them up in a head-to-head race, Z Fold 3, which is a substantially more expensive phone with an image sensor which should launch faster. Again, the main camera sensor on that Samsung is a lower resolution sensor, which also should have faster autofocus. So getting into that camera app should be quicker. Oh boy, is it not. Again, wherever your concerns might be placed, I feel it's always better to demonstrate. So when I've got a OnePlus 9 Pro easily beating the Galaxy Z Fold 3 to launching the camera, you know, again, I just maybe we're letting our feelings get in the way of replicatable testing. That's all I'm saying. So if you want to see that in action, I made a short. All right, wrap up the subreddit one. Shut up. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Please keep sharing, contributing. We need more upvotes. We need more people participating. This is absolutely a labor of love to encourage more content get seen, and especially from a wider and broader community of techies than the big top major channels that don't actually test the smartphones they review. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. We thank you for your participation. So, let's see. McCorkran, I am so far behind, dude. McCorkran says, how good were the NFL games this weekend? I have not been paying attention. My entire social media feed was just blowing up. So I have to imagine that the games were very good. I really wasn't watching any of it. So sorry. I'm not going to be the guy to kind of help out that conversation. I want to be more into the NFL. I used to be like just a diehard Broncos fan, super obnoxious about it. And increasingly just my issues with the NFL as an organization and with individual team owners has kind of chilled some of the fun. And I don't want to get too soapboxy, but it's also like, you know, why aren't we doing a better job of care for players, of maybe revising some of the rules to make it a little bit more rugby-like? We're still sort of treating this like gladiators, and people get excited when players get hurt, and I think that's an ugly look for the game. I'm the wrong guy to talk about football right now, because, again, it's the excitement of the postseason and it's kind of not my jam right now. from Russ 91231, do you feel that the fingerprint scanner can be improved on the Pixel 6 lineup, or is it the type of scanner that they're using? So the fingerprint scanner has already been improved. What you can do in terms of software to improve the performance of the fingerprint sensor was fixed like a couple weeks after launch. I didn't have any serious issues with it at launch. But again, this comes down to, are you properly judging a spectrum of devices, or are you declaring one phone the winner and everything else is garbage? Because if we rank the Pixel 6 and the 6 Pro on the entire continuity of fingerprint sensors, the 6 was well above average at launch. There are truly abysmally terrible fingerprint sensor in-display fingerprint sensors. And then there are pretty good in-display fingerprint sensors, and it's not one or the other. There's a spectrum in between, so awful I don't want to use the phone on a daily basis, to pretty good. This is a reasonable interaction. And I stop it there, because any in-display fingerprint sensor pales in comparison to a very good, dedicated hardware fingerprint sensor on the back of the phone or on a power button. If you want the absolute best biometric security interaction, you need a dedicated piece of hardware, and it needs to have its own tactile landmark. A screen does not have a tactile spot where you can feel where your finger needs to properly be placed to get the most consistent action for unlocking your phone. You, as the consumer, need to train your muscle memory to better unlock the phone, and it's still never going to be perfect because completely featureless piece of glass versus tactile hardware landmark. No in-display fingerprint sensor is ever going to be as good and as consistent as a rear fingerprint sensor or a power button fingerprint sensor. Whatever voodoo Xiaomi is building into their phones right now, I will go head-to-head with anyone. Anyone who says in-display fingerprint sensors are good, not just acceptable, but are good competitors, a no-look 10 times unlock. We'll go around a 10. First person to unlock the phone without staring at the screen 10 times, I'll put up $1,000. How about that? If you can go 10 unlocks without staring at the phone to give it all of your visual attention while you work a tactile biometric security feature, if you can beat me and get to 10 proper unlocks before I can, you got $1,000. We'll go head to head, and we've got to do it live, so you can't do any editing or any funny business, but we'll make that happen. Because right now, I feel like the criteria that people are judging the Pixel 6, completely garbage criteria. One time I felt like it didn't unlock as fast as it should. Yeah, when I hold up this phone and I unlock it, like, it's fine, it's good, but it's an in-display fingerprint sensor. It's better than the in-display that was used on the LG Velvet by a lot. It's better than the in-display that's used on a TCL, so that's good. It might be a little less snappy than a OnePlus 9 Pro, but it's real close. Like, here, let me... And this is tricky to kind of demonstrate for myself because I'm going left thumb, right thumb. But, like, I pop that. Yeah, it was exactly the same. My experience for having unlocked both of these phones just right here in front of me would have been perceptually exactly the same. So I'm not impressed with people still complaining. Not you, Russ. What I mean is by techies and reviewers. Oh, but it was so garbage. No, it really wasn't. And I really hate that kind of limited scope, because to me that means you probably didn't really live with it. You probably really didn't get a feel for it. Streamy boys, I've never had any issues with the fingerprint sensor on my Pixel 6. I've never been able to replicate the issue that everyone claims to have had with the fingerprint sensor. It's fine. It really is. I've got to get around all this football conversation here. Ditya, the fingerprint scanner on the iPhone 13 Pro Max is the best. Admit it, Juan. You know deep down it's true. That's hilarious. Oh, Ditya, you're my favorite troll. Simon says, Hypno says, my fingerprint sensor was very slow, but has improved, especially after the January update. I'd still prefer a power button fingerprint sensor. Again, anyone rational who cares about that ergonomic experience, I want the phone completely unlocked and ready to use as it's coming out of my pocket. And right now, Xiaomi is blowing my mind. Huawei was incredible back in like the Mate 10 Pro days. That fingerprint sensor was just insanely quick for its time. Anytime. Or you know, like the rear fingerprint sensors on LG phones were just ergonomically better. The phone was in a ready state of use before I was giving it attention to try and unlock it. That to me was a much better practical consideration. Streamy Boys has a fantastic sensor on his Pixel 6 Pro. King Turtle. So this is what I mean. King Turtle writes, I remember hearing that the Nokia 9 fingerprint sensor was very rough and unfortunately still is. Very rough is incredibly kind. You know how I set that threshold? Like, an in-display fingerprint sensor can be okay, or it can be so abysmally terrible that you don't want to use the phone. That's the Nokia 9. And especially at the price of the Nokia 9, that was, I mean, that to me would have legitimately been a deal breaker for consumers. I suffered through that phone expecting updates and improvements, making it better. It was horrifically inaccurate, miserably slow. I feel it never really got out of that compromised tier where it might not have even have been secure, where people were able to like unlock it with a stick of chewing gum just mashed against the screen. That kind of looks like thumbprints. Sure, I'll unlock the phone. I would also have put like maybe, was it Galaxy S9 or Galaxy S10 where you could trick the fingerprint sensor with just like a piece of plastic? Like if you mashed a plastic case against, I think it was a Galaxy S9. Someone please correct me. But that was horrifically insecure and updates improved it, but it never really became as good as a proper dedicated fingerprint sensor. And yeah, McCorcoran, I miss being able to slide my finger down the back of the phone to extend my quick settings. There was a nice sort of ergonomic or practical use for some of that. I don't like the tap back. On a Pixel 6, you can set up a shortcut where you tap the back of the phone and it launches something. Because the phone gets jostled enough, I was using it for launching the assistant, and I had to stop because the assistant would keep getting launched inadvertently. So I don't think that tactile, as a tactile interaction, is going to be as good as like having a programmable button or some other type of, like a dedicated fingerprint sensor.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey there, Juan, and hey there, you. This is Jason Howell from All About Android over at the twit.tv podcast network. Juan has been a guest on All About Android a number of times. In fact, we have awesome guests on the show each and every week, and we'd love for you to check out the show if you haven't already. Twit.tv/AAA is where you can go to find new episodes of All About Android. Each and every week, we talk about the top Android news, hardware, apps. We have a reviews portion called The Arena. It's very competitive, but in a fun way. We have a really great time doing this show, and we would love for you to join us sometime and check it out. We get journalists from throughout the Android world joining us. We even sometimes get Googlers who are actually making Android on the show to talk about what we love so much about the world of Android. That's twit.tv/AAA for new episodes of All About Android each and every Tuesday. All right, Juan, back to you.
Yeah, from Russ, even Xiaomi's in-display fingerprint sensors are insanely fast, even if they are using an optical one. They're quick. I still think OnePlus has the edge on them for using the optical sensors. Where is it? The big problem I have... So here's the Mi 11 Ultra. Yeah, the Mi 11 Ultra. It is demonstrably slower than a Mi 11i. You know, the sort of lower tier Mi 11. And when I go, oh, I also haven't turned it on for a day, so it's making me put in my PIN. So when I go to unlock this, so like it took two pulses that time. It is so much harder to perfectly line up the scanned image of your thumbprint. It's like you've really got to think exactly where is the sensor, and then the placement matters for how you get on top of it versus the Mi 11, where I don't think about it. I am pulling the phone out of my pocket and my thumb naturally rests on the power button because of the shape of an evolved primate hand, and the phone is just open and it's just ready to go. So it is pretty good because of the way that it does the vibration pulse, the haptic feedback, and it does an animation. I actually think that's what's slowing it down. I think it's trying to look really cool because it knows most of the people that are using in-display sensors are already looking at the phone before they started fully unlocking it. And to me, that's like dumb user hand-holding. And I don't want that. I want advanced user readiness. I'm being kind of insulting there. But, you know, it is what it is. Yeah, Kappa Cash, it's galaxies better than the Nokia 9. I mean, it just Nokia 9 just breaks my heart on every piece of what that phone was. It's going to be so long before I ever really feel like giving a Nokia another chance. It's just so gross. That phone could have been so amazing, but it needed a ton more work. Oh, Russ is saying it might have been the S10 using the ultrasonic. So, okay, maybe it was the S10. The S10 that I lived with was the S10e, because the S10e has the vastly superior power button fingerprint sensor. Sorry, I got a little dance for the last Samsung phone that I truly enjoyed using. Yeah, Z Fold 3, better fingerprint sensor on the power button. it just works. We got sidetracked there. I did want to highlight, there was a great video from Windows Central. I'm not going to go too deep into this, but it makes me sad seeing what some of the development process and what some of the possible futures we could have had. Microsoft was working on another mobile operating system. It was called Andromeda OS. This video is such a bittersweet walk down memory lane. All the things I loved about Windows Phone, some obvious attention being paid to more advanced use and journaling and scripting and stylus support, dual display support going baked into a mobile device, and it wasn't delivering and they weren't getting the project up to speed, so they killed it and they decided to go with Android instead. But it makes me sad because I feel if we had had more competition and Microsoft had been better at kind of keeping pace, like they were putting out operating systems in a way that resembled a desktop market. And that doesn't work for mobile devices. You need to have a much more regular calendar of update and support. And I feel like that's one of the biggest internal problems with how Microsoft handled their mobile strategy. But you can definitely catch that video. Everything's going to be linked here, but windowscentral.com, Zach Bowden. This is Microsoft's canceled Andromeda OS running on a Lumia 950. And you really want to be sad that we could have different features and different interactions and better UI for a lot of these gesture-based interactions. That's what we could have had. Like, I feel like Android is being stretched to its breaking point just having swipes. Like, it's taken us 3 years to figure out swiping and moving. I can swipe it and I can move it. Oh, whoa, Android, slow down there. You can swipe and move? I don't think so. So yeah, it's pretty rough. King Turtle, you're in good company. A lot of us here were really into the Windows phone. And Streamy Boys, it was a great video. I really liked it. McCorkran, I know I have to grab my Surface Duo and update it. I've been keeping pace. The Duo 1 is such a lovely little gadget. And obviously there are still some like little sticky bits. But the more I use this and I try to use it for what Microsoft sort of intends it to be, the more I feel like it does that stuff right. And Microsoft deserves a ton of credit for making Android do the things that Android cannot do. So obviously there are issues with individual apps and services and still some rotation and orientation stuff. And like, yeah, I get it. but I'm not savaging the duo because it's ambitious. You know, like that to me is the silliest part of this. Like, we want our gadgets to get better, but no, but they also have to be perfect. Even though like iPhones launch with some crazy silly bugs, Galaxies launch with crazy silly bugs, but an even more radically ambitious piece of hardware needs to be perfect. Cool. That's some real good tech reviewing there, YouTubers. Good on ya. Gormlord, I'm still waiting for L cars to come to mobile phones. I mean, like, it would be kind of fun to go completely Star Trek The Next Generation on a pocket computer. It would be fun. All right, let me get this to here. We've got one more actual proper story, and then we can maybe let that kick off some other just sort of general conversation about phones and gadgets and the stuff. Here, let me pull this article up. This is coming from Econotimes.com. Samsung Galaxy S22 price leak suggests the Ultra model will only get 8GB and 12GB RAM options. So who wrote this up? Do they have a byline? I don't know that they do. Okay. A new leak from a reliable source has debunked speculations that the Galaxy S22 series would be cheaper. While the starting prices for the upcoming models are unchanged, the biggest adjustment appears to be the Ultra variant. Reports suggest that the next high-end device will have lower RAM options than what was available for predecessors. And this is coming from Roland Quant, claiming to have the official Euro prices. So the starter Galaxy S22 with 8GB of RAM and 128GB of storage, €849. That is spendy for the plasticky, smallest, lowest resolution screened, cheapest built Galaxy FE inspired version of an S series Galaxy. I genuinely hope that this is not accurate because Samsung is completely losing the plot. But I guess you need to pay for $10 billion a year of advertising by making your customers pay more for arguably pretty mediocre kinds of phones. But obviously the one that I think we're all going to be a bit more anxious about is the return of the Note. And I refuse to call it a Galaxy S. It is not a Galaxy S. It has different components, significantly different cameras, it has S Pen technology, it is the Note 22. I will only refer to this phone as the Note 22 because it is the stupidest of branding exercises to pretend that this is a Galaxy S just so you can get all of those headlines. They're literally in my feeds right now. The Galaxy S22 Ultra is going to be the perfect way to pay homage to the Galaxy Note series. Shut up. Oh my God. How many outlets have to be that thirsty for Samsung clicks that they're writing these really insightful editorials about the name of a phone that is exactly the same as the last phone, which had a different name? Oh, this is so different. It's not a Note anymore. It's a Galaxy S Ultra. Shut up. So, the Galaxy Note 22, as I go back into screen share, 8GB of RAM, 128GB of storage, €1,249. That is so much. So the component shortages and the distribution issues and the manufacturing issues, making their own SoC, that is a lot. That's a lot of money. I need everyone to remember when the LG V60 came out with 8GB of RAM and 128GB of storage. had all of the same features minus the higher resolution display, did not have a faster frame rate display, but launched at $799 active Pen Stylus support, an easily $150 headphone jack, dual display. You could use two screens at the same time. You could turn it into a bigger, higher resolution version of a Galaxy Fold if you wanted to. You didn't even have to. And people were complaining that, well, LG, their LGs are always too expensive at launch. $799 starting price. Galaxy S22 Ultra. No. Galaxy Note 22, 8 gig, 128 gigs of storage, no storage upgradeability, €1,249.
Okay.
So I really feel Samsung is missing the focus. You know, what this means is the excitement for Galaxy S products has been waning substantially. Since the Galaxy S10, we've seen a stark drop in Galaxy S series sales and a huge lift in Galaxy A series sales. So all these techies that try to make it seem like Samsung is the market leader, Samsung sells the most phones, so consumers must really like Galaxy S changes, are completely incorrect. You know, you can kind of make that claim with Apple that they'll buy it regardless. Doesn't matter if it has a notch, doesn't matter if they get rid of the headphone jack, doesn't matter if they cut the charger from the box, where are they going to go? If you need a new iPhone, you need to buy an iPhone. But increasingly, we're seeing, as Samsung has made these changes to copy Apple, their customers have increasingly supported their lines of products that are less like Apple. The Galaxy A series represents everything that used to be the good stuff about Android. That's where their customers are going. Samsung sold more phones in total in 2021 than they did in 2020. They sold significantly less Galaxy S phones in 2021 than they did in 2020. And even more so if we factor in 2019. They're voting with their wallets. It's techies that still keep pretending that this is the right course and kind of giving Samsung a pass on business models that are absolutely terrible for premium Android. This makes the entire premium Android landscape lesser because they're basically just trying to ape the success of Apple by making Apple-like cuts to their products. Just stunning, stunning. So if you don't want a horrifically crippled Galaxy Note 22 with an adequate amount of RAM and an inadequate amount of storage, you can climb up to the 12 gig, 256 gigabyte model. Again, just like Apple, Samsung is trying to create pain point devices. So it kind of hurts to live with this model, but you can't do anything to fix it. You just got to step up and buy the more expensive phone. Can't fix it with a memory card. No, that would be too cheap. Don't be cheap. Give all your money to Samsung and Apple. So Galaxy Note 22 with 12 gigs of RAM and double the storage, €100 more. I don't know about you, but a 256 gig memory card would be a more cost-effective way to pack all my media on a phone. But I can't upgrade the storage on a Note 22. I'm going to be stuck with whatever they sell me at launch. And then if you really want to go heavy, a Note 22 with 12 gigs of RAM and 512 gigs of storage, $1,449. $1,449. Another $100, at least when you go €100 here, you're getting an additional 256 gigs. So again, because of the way that we stack internal memory chips, you can double 128s and get to 256. That costs you 100 because you also get 4 gigs more RAM. But keeping the RAM the same, when you go another 100 euro, you get 256 gigs of additional storage. Okay, great. That's great. I really hope this is wrong. And also, if these are the MSRPs, then we know about 3 weeks after launch, they're going to cut $200 off the price of this on a sale. Do not buy any S22 or Note 22 at launch. You are, even with a trade-in, don't do it. You will be the consumer who is hurt by your Samsung fandom. Wait a month. Watch the pricing over a couple weeks. I believe the S21s went on reasonable sales about 3 weeks after launch. It did not take long. There was the ratchet, the excitement. A bunch of big YouTubers get early access because that's the way that Samsung works. They've got one of the most punitive PR divisions in the history of consumer electronics. So those people will be so hyped. All of the tech outlets are out right now writing articles about, well, I mean, the Galaxy S21 FE isn't a total miserable failure. There are still some good things about it, too. Kind of sus, right? Do the kids still say sus? Because I feel like that one's appropriate. Don't buy the S21 FE. I was telling people not to buy the S21. The S21 FE is an even worse buy. It makes the S21 an okay buy. That's how bad the S21 FE is. We've got a couple first-time chats and comments here I do want to get back. Let me see if I can find Tech Junkies. hold on. Oof, I just splashed water up my nose. You all be missing LG now, huh? Says Aditya. King Turtle. I mean, it's not, they're not even being coy about it. Galaxy S is really trying to become a faux iPhone, and it just makes the iPhone look like a better buy. Why would I buy an S21 or an S22 when I could just go and buy an iPhone? I'd get all the perks of being in the Apple ecosystem and all of the same compromises. There's so little. Literally now, the only thing I can kind of recommend for Samsung fans is find a solution to keep up with DeX. If you liked an advanced feature like DeX, you have to keep giving Samsung money or else they'll get rid of that feature. They got rid of it on the Z Flip. Something tells me they're going to start cutting DeX from the S series as well. And it never made it to the A series. Let me tell you, running Screen Plus on an LG Velvet was awesome. Yes, it's not as powerful. You can't do as advanced computing on a desktop mode on a mid-ranger phone. Still, plenty of things that you can do that help take the edge off needing a travel companion notebook or another additional computer in your house. Screen Plus on the Velvet was awesome. There is no reason why Samsung couldn't bring DeX to A-series phones, except they'd have to beef up the USB port, and it might make their phones just a little bit more expensive to manufacture. And, oh, but I mean, who does things on their phones? So, I mean, again, I was such a diehard Samsung knight when Samsung was putting every new tech in the kitchen sink into every phone. It's why I still point to like my Note 4, which is over on that table. It's why I still like my Galaxy S10e. If that's what you're going to do, that's literally the only argument left for buying a Samsung. Literally, at this point and at these prices, so many other solutions that you can kind of shop or you can compare. McCorkran, that's funny. Although at least iPhone is adding RAM to their phones, not taking it away from last year. All right, so we had Tech Junkie 452. This is a first time comment. Thank you for checking out the stream. If the Note 22 is that expensive, I think I'll take a chance and buy a Xiaomi, even with the lack of T-Mobile band support. So I feel this is the right time to shop and compare some of the other options that are available. If this is Samsung's strategy for a premium slate phone, because to me it seems pretty clear, they want the excitement to be on foldables and they want to rule foldables like they ruled OLED for like 10 years. They're not going to. Using the Z Fold 3, It's a great beta test, but it's not the finished idea of what a foldable phone should be. And they're already facing way too much competition to lock up foldables like they locked up OLEDs. You could also check out a Sony. Again, let me just pull this up. BHphotovideo.com. Xperia Pro I. So the pros and cons, right? So if we follow this leak, and it's almost 1,500 euro, 1,449 for 512 gigs of storage space and 12 gigs of RAM. So there are definitely components that swap back and forth, but you would have one of the most brilliant camera sensors ever put into a phone with a two-stage photographic aperture and memory card expansion and a headphone jack with proper sub-6 5G band support in the United States. And you'd have some really other killer features, like the ability to use this as a monitor for a camera. You can plug in an HDMI input. The telephoto camera is not as good as what you would get on the Galaxy. You would not have DeX, but then you'd also have some of the best advanced power management features available on any device. So, HS power control, the ability to minimize heat. This would be, in my opinion, I mean, it's definitely more expensive. It's like $350 more expensive. Man, I'd much rather be rocking something like this. And especially like bleeding edge tech coming in for the display, higher resolution display that can also fall back to 1080p at 120 hertz. Like, that to me would be my jam. If I'm going to spend so much money on a phone, I can do more with the actual phone on a Sony. If you don't need that crazy, ridiculous, over-the-top camera, you could go with an Xperia 1 Mark III and still get the headphone jack, still get the upgradable storage. You know, you'd have a memory card slot, and you'd get the better telephoto. You'd have that dual stage, that two-stage telephoto camera. That could also be. So again, if you're anxious about like carrier band support, Xiaomi's are making great products. I've been a huge fan of Vivo and some of the other BBK brands, but there are some players still shipping to the United States that are making some cool stuff here too. From Maddie Cobbs, also a first-time comment. The thing I've noticed is that it's suddenly now that tech reviewers are starting to talk about LG and about how they miss them, yet they were one of the main characteristics to their downfall. LG was the whipping boy. It's fair to say LG's issues in the smartphone market were LG's fault. LG marketing completely failed to find Western audiences and to make the case for their products as exciting competition against Apple and Samsung. I have said that basically since the G5, when they did that ridiculous ad with Jason Statham, where he played every character in a little action set piece, and it wasn't about the phone at all. It was just, look at how weird it is that Jason Statham's face is on every character in this mini short film commercial. I felt like LG consistently kept missing the point in their marketing about telling people that they needed to have this phone. And when you get to something as brilliant as the LG V60, their tagline was, do more at once. It wasn't do more better, or, do twice as much, or, do the impossible. It was just literally the factual, you can do two things at the same time. It's like just so low energy. And that to me is the main issue there. But along the way, what we've seen is, there is a consistent trend in algorithmically based YouTubery where you need to make sure that your views stay high. If some videos start dropping, YouTube's algorithm will recommend your channel less. And if you get less views, then that's less money. So if you make a video about LG, you don't really make the video about LG. You make the video about why you should buy a Samsung instead of this LG, and that larger community of Samsung fans will all pat themselves on the back and love your video, and then you make more money. So right now we're watching this sort of split. Sony still gets that kind of tangent recognition that they, Sony still makes phones? I'm so clever. But to me, I think it's OnePlus. We saw the community turn hard on OnePlus. There's now some really xenophobic and kind of racist hot takes on this Chinese company taking over their beloved enthusiast brand that was manufactured and developed in China. And just like a really bad look as we're looking at who else can we punch down on? Because you still need to make, if you claim to be a well-rounded, all-rounder reviewer, there are some people out there that make a much better play at saying, this is what my channel is about, and these are the products that I like, and that's what I'm going to focus on. It's curious to me that those channels typically seem to always be Apple or Samsung channels. How convenient that your favorite products are the products that also bring you in the most YouTube ad revenue. But at least they're being honest. I'm an iPhone user. This is an iPhone primary channel. It's frustrating because if someone isn't honest about their preference and they're making the most money from probably three, Xiaomi videos are really hot right now, and that includes like Poco, but Xiaomi videos, Apple videos, and Samsung videos. So then when they get a OnePlus, well, it's obviously the loser. It has to be the loser. Wait a minute, this wasn't a comparison. We weren't comparing two phones. OnePlus is in Pixels, they're the losers. And that way, in the middle of my Pixel review, I can talk about how you should buy a Galaxy instead. I gave this phone like a week of not really using it, and now I'm gonna go back to my Samsung. Okay, I don't really think you used it. Because if you were really kind of comparing, I mean, there are things that a Samsung can do really well. I mean, I love DeX. I love having video out. Pixel does a lot of other things way better. So where was that balance in the conversation? Who is this one phone for and who is this other phone for? Instead of trying to make it sound like objectively the winner is the phone that makes me the most YouTube ad revenue. Objectively. And so that's the ugly trend. That's the frustrating part of all of this is it doesn't feel quite as genuine as it used to. When I started doing editorial and freelance work for outlets, there was an expectation that the articles that brought in the most revenue were these big, you know, like Apple stories, big Samsung stories. Especially when I started, it was HTC. HTC was indomitable. You know, so much content was focused on HTC, and Samsung was actually kind of the upstart in mobile tech. But there was the expectation that you would test the entire lifestyle of using that phone, of using an HTC, and that success, that article's revenue, would subsidize the exact same lifestyle, time, and testing on a much, much less popular device. And now, if you were to really treat a Samsung and a OnePlus exactly the same fairly, you know, you lived your life out of the OnePlus exactly the same way that you lived your life out of an iPhone for multiple months of usage to really get familiar with it, you know that YouTube is going to punish you for that. You know those videos aren't going to draw as much traffic. They're not going to be recommended as heavily to your viewers and subscribers. All the people who smash the bell icon are not going to get notified. And it's going to hurt your channel metrics, so your future videos aren't recommended as heavily. So it's one part creator, one part platform, but ultimately it creates this toxic feedback loop where if I know this product is not innately as popular as Samsung, Xiaomi, or Apple, I have to punch down on it for the largest fans, the largest groups of fans, to make sure that they're happy with the commentary, and that keeps my channel metrics higher, and that keeps my view rate and attach rate higher, and that's going to make sure I'm compensated for the amount of work it takes to produce these videos. Can confirm, my videos do garbage traffic on YouTube. And lately I've been wearing that as a badge of honor. McCorkran 3, you could import the new Oppo for the same price.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
TK, see, TK, this is why I'm suspect about a leak. I'm covering this. I don't know that it's 100%, and I really hope it's wrong. But TK says, the storage upgrade from 128 to 256 last year was $50. But you see, if the rumor about cutting RAM is true, then it's not just 128 gigs of storage, it's also 4 gigs of RAM. So that 4 gigs of RAM is another $50. I don't know if you've bought a laptop or I'm working on a new mini PC. So this is the Geekom, I think that's how you say their name, the Geekom mini PC, and it's an adorable little competitor to a Nook, but with like a pretty decent last gen Core i5 in here, and their pricing for like adding RAM and storage. You can get it factory pre-configured or you can just get it as a bare bones kit. I love these types of little mini PCs. I adore just the performance and power to price ratio of these insanely tiny little boxes. It's this little box and you can stick it to anything and it becomes like a full-fledged, really powerful laptop grade computer and it's brilliant. But you know, this is a starting price of like $499 for some pretty decently mid-spec laptop grade components, all in a tiny little package shell with ports. Like you got USB 3 and DisplayPort and HDMI, and it's lovely and I love it. So again, if you're gonna do 4 gigabytes of RAM, that's obviously another $50. Simply your device. That's dirty. One, the carriers will just give these phones away for all the port-ins. Actually, yeah. I mean, see, again, this is what's so frustrating is Samsung should, if Samsung really is the market leader, we should be holding them up to that standard of really driving the premium Android market. Instead, they're devaluing their own products aggressively. They're playing all of these pricing shenanigans with trade-in deals and sales, and they're trying to wreck the resale market so that people just keep giving their own phones back to them so they can get new phones. They're making premium Android look way cheaper and way less good than iPhones. So when people have the disposable income to really treat themselves with a nicer phone, they're not going to think about Android because Androids look like cheap alternatives, like gross cheap alternatives, instead of really living up to that price tag and really living up to that conversation. You can cringe at a Sony's price, but internationally right now, Sony's are becoming that crown jewel exclusive boutique solution that the learned consumers who want to spend a lot of money on something different and be seen having spent a lot of money on something, are selling like hotcakes in China and Japan. They cannot keep them on store shelves. They're selling out so aggressively. So even from the fashion standpoint, Samsung is doing a miserable job of carrying the torch for nicer and expensive smartphones. Yeah, and Gabaletta, I agree. I mean, you're taking it back that far. It's such a shame because these products can be such a powerhouse if Samsung returned back to their S7 era. I mean, the up until the S8, I would always be really concerned about Samsung batteries. Now from the S6 and S7 era, I've had 3 phones go battery puff, and I've had 5 phones just refuse to hold a charge. So those older Samsungs definitely did turn into spicy pillows and potential incendiary devices. But to me, it's like the S10 and Note 10 are kind of peak Samsung, and everything after that is not as good, really not as good, less useful, less lifestyle. And those things are still so powerful today that they can largely keep pace with S21s if you use your S21 in battery power saver mode. The Snapdragon 855 is totally capable as a premium tier computing platform today. Dave Burns, we're now at the media literacy portion of the podcast. I do that a lot. I know that kind of infiltrates a lot of my reviews, but it's kind of mandatory because I still bring these things up and people are like, no, but I mean, like, Samsung's are the best. You're just a hater. McCorkorin 3. We've seen a bit of that. He's quoting, not literally quoting, but sort of writing a script a la what we've seen from some other tech reviewers. So in my last video, I said the Galaxy Buds Pro were just okay, and a lot of you were really mad at me, so I gave them another chance. And again, like, look at how much ire and how much frustration people threw at Pixel 6, at OnePlus 9s, completely undervaluing all of the hardware and manufacturing on the Surface Duo. All of these alternative products that, like, had very specific pros and cons that were different than Samsung pros and cons, but I felt really rose to the occasion and kind of earned their MSRPs. But, like, they play with it for a week after launch, they never revisit it, and they try to come to some kind of conclusion where their criticisms are all things that they would give Apple and Samsung a pass on. But for this product, it's a total deal breaker. You know, like when someone's holding a Duo and they're like, but I'm trying to like use the Duo, like I'm doing this thing. And like, you would never use any other phone like that. Like wildly slapping your paw against the screen and then complaining that it's not responding to your interaction. And you're like, but you're trying to make it look like the Duo is so problematic. Or you know, you're trying to complain about how insanely tall an Xperia 5 is by putting it next to an iPhone mini on a slant. So it makes the iPhone mini look even shorter. And just what is Sony thinking? Their form factor is so ridiculous when it's the narrowest phone available and it's only like a forehead bezel taller than a Galaxy S10e. A mini-sized phone like the S10e. And to me, that is tech review and tech commentary in very bad faith. And you're absolutely trying to game the conversation that way. Sorry, I'm way behind on the chat. So I know you guys have obviously moved on from where I'm at right here. So I'm just going to kind of wrap this up as we get to the last 10 minutes. If there's anything else that you guys would like to talk about instead of me complaining about Galaxy Note 22 pricing, we can kind of wrap this up with something else. I know someone tweeted. Where was a tweet? Did I close my Twitter? Let's see. Come join the fun. Oh, so from Removable Sanity. I can go into screen share here. And I think this, you know, maybe we can end on something like this. Not a story, but maybe a general question. Does the warranty of tech influence your decision to buy said tech? And I got that question just as I put my call out to sort of promote the show this week. I really can't think of a product that I've purchased with my own money that you're like, hey, I really want this, I really need it, and this is something that's going to be a part of my workflow or a daily driver or a laptop, you know, a smartphone that I've actually purchased with my own money. I can't remember the last time I looked back and thought, better check the manufacturer's warranty. So I was kind of curious if anyone else out there has had that kind of an experience where they're really thinking like, I was about to buy this, a monitor, speakers, a TV, but then I saw it only had a 1-year manufacturer's warranty and I didn't think that that was good enough. When it's something like warranty related, I kind of feel the sort of narrow doesn't cover accidental damage, doesn't cover water damage, doesn't cover any kind of lifestyle abuse, but just the if the product is faulty kind of warranty has mattered very, very little to me. Occasionally I have insured and I've bought extended warranties for things like my cameras, like my production cameras, like I make money on those. So I've got a different kind of consideration for that. But I genuinely don't much care what the manufacturer warranty is because Panasonic isn't going to cover any accidental damage anyway. If there's going to be a problem with one of these products, I feel it likely will have manifested within a year of owning that product. So I don't know. Has anyone else, like, what your take is? Like, has there been a situation where you wanted to go and get something, but then you were worried about the longer term coverage or support from a warranty perspective? Obviously, it's a different conversation when we're talking about software updates and bug fixes and patches. Like, that kind of stuff weighs heavy on my purchasing behavior. But that's not really a warranty thing. You know, that's not like, I'm having this problem 2 years into the device because of the software update. Better check my warranty. I just assume that that's not a thing. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm throwing money away. We'll have to see. Yeah, from McCorkran, I think tech enthusiasts are more willing to overlook a warranty if they love a product. I'm always shopping used Android phones looking for deals, and I'm sure there are limited warranties on any of those, if any. Like, if they're refurbs, there should be a manufacturer limited warranty. If it's used, nah, I mean, I would never assume that I could ever do anything with that as a warranty. Dave Burns, most warranties are ripoffs. I have to kind of agree, but I do still like tacitly pay for the mainstream bread and butter, this is how I make my money gear. I do pay for extended support on those types of products. I always run into issues whenever I've had to try and use those extended warranties. But after I cracked the camera sensor on my Samsung NX30, I was at Pocket Now, and Pocket Now didn't really have my back. It was sort of just a style. Like, I'm doing all of this work for Pocket Now on my own hardware. And it took a lot of fighting for them to buy a Pocket Now camera that I could have access to keep making reviews for Pocket Now. But ever since then, for the stuff that I buy for myself, I do pay in usually like a 3-year, because I kind of figure at that point, the replacement of that gadget, cameras, I might start looking at even longer support and what's the word I'm looking to? Insurance policies. But for a lot of this other stuff, after about 3 years, I might already be looking at flipping something else. From Gabaletta, the crazy part is when it comes to smartphones, I never really looked into the manufacturer's warranty because I knew they only covered malfunction or damage caused by the device itself rather than consumer-induced damage. In the past 10 years, I've only had to claim a manufacturer warranty on the new Galaxy Buds 2 because the drivers went bad within the first week. I'm in exactly the same situation. So we got a couple other questions here, and I think I can kind of wrap these up just as we start closing down the show. I want to give us a couple extra minutes because I was a little late coming to my own podcast. From Russ, is the reason why the 8 Gen 1 is overheating because Samsung manufactured it or because Qualcomm or manufacturers downplay the power? Because the 865 was by TSMC, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. I'm not inclined to lay all the blame on Samsung's fabrication. So Qualcomm comes up with this design for an SoC, they have to partner very closely with Samsung as a partner for the manufacturing, fabrication, and distribution of it. There are so many little moving parts. And on this giant SoC, there are all these other components. It's not just a CPU and a GPU. It's an entire system on a chip. And then that has to talk to other components in the device. I feel there is probably a marketing and distribution disconnect between Qualcomm engineers, smartphone manufacturers, and consumers. I don't know that... I don't believe, and I don't have good data to back this up, so take this or leave this opinion, I don't believe it's easy to say 8 Gen 1 doesn't perform as well because Samsung is fabbing it. What we'll need to see is if we can get two phones from the same manufacturer. Like, I want two Xiaomi 12s. And we need one with an 8 Gen 1 fabbed by Samsung. And if there's any opportunity to get an 8 Gen 1 fabbed by TSMC, that would be the only way for us to know if the fabrication is contributing this much to the performance issues that we might see in overheating. From Qualcomm's perspective, I believe, again, I don't have any insider information, but I believe Qualcomm engineers have come up with an SoC, and they've come up with sort of a best practices on how to deploy that SoC in a mobile product. And I think they are passing the thermal issues onto the manufacturers. So they know within this power tolerance, within these thermal limits, this chip can do this. So it's on you to build your phone around what we've detailed for these thermal limits and these power considerations. Then the manufacturer says, oh, but this might increase, you know, the cost of graphite or copper or vapor chambers. And then we also might have to worry about this type of software development. That's going to increase costs. Then we also have to look at the distribution of these materials and how we're importing and packaging and assembling all of these products. And we have to make sure that the assembly of a more complicated heat distribution unit can be worked into our manufacturing lines. And that's going to increase costs. And I think they might be looking, like when I look at the performance on the Motorola, I forget which phone it is, but Motorola is the first phone out with an 8 Gen 1, and it's getting so hot. I mean, we've seen tests where it'll hit like 60 degrees Celsius, which is insane to see a phone in the high 50s. Like, that's crazy hot. To me, that's Motorola looking at their entire assembly and not really taking to heart the guidelines from Qualcomm engineers. So Qualcomm has made a chip that runs hot if you let it, but Motorola has also packaged it in a device that was probably built around the power and thermal considerations of the 865, which is the last generation, I think, of premium tier SoCs. Motorola, I don't think, did anything with the 888. So those are all the moving parts. I don't think it's as easy to say Samsung bad, TSMC good. I think it's Qualcomm concerns, manufacturers' deployment, are they all on the same page? And I don't believe that they are. I think what we saw from phones at the beginning of the year with the 888, saw a lot of phones that were built more like 865s, but with a much hotter engine. Phones at the end of this year with 888s weren't as sprinter fast in individual tests, but were much better behaved. Again, the difference between a Xiaomi Mi 11 at the beginning of the year and a Vivo X70 Pro Plus at the end of the year is night and day different. The Vivo was better behaved for gaming, better behaved for longer stretches of video recording. I mean, just soup to nuts. Like, we saw manufacturers adapt to the beginning of the year phones. So that is an incredibly long-winded and rambling way of trying to describe what I see. I don't know that we can be sure if if the fabrication is the culprit. And there are way too many other factors and variables to consider. But if we could get an 8-gen one fabbed by two different companies, we could compare then if we could put them into the same products with similar software, similar manufacturing. That's the only way we could do it. Sorry. Copacash. What's my take on the Mi 11 Ultra cameras? So here is the Xiaomi Mi 11. This has one of the largest production grade camera sensors. It's second only to the Leica, and it's even just a little bit bigger than the main camera in the Pixel 6, in the Xperia Pro I, S21 Ultra. I mean, this is a really big honkin' main camera sensor. I'm going to be putting out a full video a year late, but you know, a year later, but that's going to go to the Patreon. The sort of short consideration, it is very good camera hardware. I've got some issues with how it's employed, how it's being employed on this phone. And I feel, unfortunately, that even a year later, there are some other opportunities for consumer ease of use with some of the fun features on the Mi 11 that are not being realized. I feel that if I had purchased this phone with my own money at the beginning of the year, I would still be insanely happy with the main camera sensor performance, but I think I would be critically disappointed with a number of the supporting features that are advertised on this phone, and I'll have to dig into that in more detail on patreon.com/somegadgetguy. That's going to be coming out soon. Like, I've got all the samples and I'm going through and I'm comparing, but really it's a lot of usage and ergonomic stuff that kind of sours me on the Mi 11 Ultra. Oh, Sveticus, we've kind of talked about some of this before, so I'm not going to dig too much into it here. Did we discuss the Exynos 2200 new benchmark leaks? I'm excited for it. I'm not really one to dig too deep into benchmark leaks because benchmarks do a terrible job of predicting real-world performance. You know, when I'm looking at all these tests, like we saw with all the Dimensity Mule units, cool. I mean, it is really cool. We're seeing improvements to the GPU for virtual testing. We're seeing improvements to the CPU. Doesn't mean anything. I can show you phones that get the biggest benchmark scores on 888s and Dimensities and iPhones. And then I try and do something practical with that, like edit photos or batch process RAW files or compress files in RAR or render video. And those phones that got the biggest benchmark scores perform about the same as phones that got lower benchmark scores. Or sometimes phones that got way lower benchmark scores, like the V60, can still outperform 888s in video rendering. So again, there's optimization issues, real-world issues, and it drives me crazy that, except for gaming, we don't really test real-world. These synthetic benchmarks are very easy to manipulate. And the SoC, especially with the A88, that is it's like an SoC that's built to get the bestest benchmark scores, but then it performs worse consistently for a lot of real world usage. So I've got a philosophical problem with that. And again, the Exynoses have never been competitive, priced dollar to dollar to dollar. Like, since we've seen the split of Samsung putting Exynos internationally and Qualcomm here in the United States, the better performers have consistently been the Qualcomm Galaxy phones. I don't see that changing. I hope AMD can show us some really cool improvements to graphics, GPU processing, but that's still going to mean developers are going to have to take advantage of that. Because we can see enormous improvements to Vulkan on Android phones. If game developers aren't taking advantage of that, then your gaming performance doesn't get any better. I'm very skeptical of the real world potential of an Exynos 2200. Mm-hmm. Dave Burns. Motorola made a great hand warmer for this winter. Sorry, let me just break this down here. McCorkerin 3. I'm it's still one of my favorite videos to put together. The aperture one is my fave, but your shutter speed test was more meaningful to me than almost any synthetic benchmark test. I mean, like, it drives me crazy. You know, like, what is it that you're complaining about and what are you comparing? Because you're talking about two numbers. Those numbers don't mean what you think they mean. And so Kenox, this is where I think we should be even more excited. I'm still waiting to see a Snapdragon 888 tablet. We could compare how different the passive cooling works on different form factors. When we talk about average consumers are very well served, using average phones. Like, a $400 phone is not a compromised device that you can kind of live with, but you save the little money so you feel good about it. Like, a Nord N10, a Pixel 4a, any of the TCLs, like those TCL 20s, beautiful phones. The daily driver experience is almost completely indistinguishable from a more expensive device. I am so over someone picking up, a $1,000 plus phone. But what about the average? This is going to do anything for average people who would never have bought an over $1,000 phone. Because average people buy average devices. Right now, the savvier, I want something nicer, but I'm looking for a deal, average consumer, isn't looking at the phone launches for 2022. They're looking at the sale pricing for phones launched in 2021, where you can get a OnePlus 9 Pro for not a lot of money. The resale prices on Galaxy S21s have plummeted. There is no resale value on Samsung. Like, it just evaporates. The nicer Xiaomis, less so with the Sonys, because again, they always launch late anyway. But that's where someone who wants an average price phone but wants the more premium experience is looking for last year's devices. So yeah, I completely agree. I really want to see some of these horsepower focused SoCs go into like laptops. I'd really love to see what that could look like driving Chrome, something like that. From Tech Junkie, I see Geekbench scores on Reddit and my eyes can't glaze over any harder. That's pretty good. For me, I always talk about how, like, I'm dislocating my eyeballs from rolling them so hard. It's the starting place. This is what drives me crazy. Is like, you would never grade laptop performance on Geekbench, right? Tell me what laptop reviewer takes a gaming PC out of the box, runs Geekbench, and goes, well, that's what you should buy. It's got the bigger Geekbench score and has an audience and hasn't been laughed out of the room for reviewing laptops like that. Hardware Unboxed, Gamers Nexus, that does not exist. That reviewer would never be able to keep an audience. When we're talking about the ultra premium tier of smartphones, there's the luxury argument. I don't make videos for people who buy expensive purses. I can't talk to that audience. That's not my audience. I talk to the people who want to get over $1,000 worth of use out of their smartphone. And it's not going to be from just fiddling around on social media and taking the occasional auto HDR snapshot point and shoot photo. I want to talk to the person who is interested in getting over $1,000 worth of use out of their $1,000 phone. So, we should probably wrap this up. My voice is actually now starting to get a little fuzzy. McCorkerin, average users haven't even heard of Geekbench. You don't do all of your work in Geekbench? I mean, the only thing I do with my phone is I turn on the phone and I feel it in my hand to see if it feels nice in my hand, and then I run Geekbench. I mean, that's the only thing you can do with a phone is run Geekbench. Maybe if I'm feeling spicy, I'll sideload Antutu. But there's what else can you do on a phone? I mean, literally nothing. It won't do anything else. Like when we see reviewers like, I don't know what to do with dual display devices. I guess I open Twitter on one screen and I can pull up a restaurant menu on the other screen. I guess that's doing two things at the same time. I can't imagine anything else that I could do. But you know, on my Fold, I can do all kinds of things at the same time. Well, folks, thanks so much for jumping in this week. Apologies again for some of the teething pains at the top of this. I do have this cute little box here on my desk. Now, I don't do a lot of giveaways. I don't really like promoting giveaways just so that more contest junkies will inflate my social media numbers. But I do like to see some participation. And I've given away a phone and a pair of really, really nice IEM earbuds. And I've gotten almost no participation. So I've got a few other things that I want to give away. But if we're going to grow giveaways so that also more of my international audience can get involved and more of, you know, folks here can do things, I might just stop again. Because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of extra work, and then I got to pack and ship things, and then I have to deal with taxes and all that fun stuff. But a member of our community sent these over. So these are the Trex Titanium Aftershocks Bone Conduction Bluetooth headphones. I still have my own pair of titaniums. These things are phenomenal, and especially if you care about, like, situation awareness, keeping your ears open, healthier hearing habits. Aftershocks and bone conduction are top of my list on this kind of alternative audio tech. So these are amazing. Aditi, no, I completely agree. Aftershocks are phenomenal. I'm going to put up information on a giveaway on somegadgetguy.com. The show notes for this week's podcast, when that blog post goes live, there's going to be information on how you can enter into this giveaway. And then next week, I'm going to draw one person at random, and they're going to get a pair of Aftershocks courtesy of one of the members of the Some Gadget Guy Discord. So this is also like an inclusive, like, trading of really cool tech. Someone had these, he wasn't going to use them, and decided to spread the wealth, you know, to share rather than just like sell them or anything like that. That's amazing. I'd love to see like a little participation, a little chatter. Again, we'll have to see. If this kind of spreads throughout just this little community, that could be cool because those are awesome headphones. So, Kappa Cash, they would be amazing for when you're running. That is like one of their primary bestest features, is having your ears open, but you can still soundtrack an activity like working out while outdoors. I'm a big, big fan of the bone conduction and the Aftershocks. So keep an eye out. That blog post will definitely be live tomorrow. So that would be January 25th. It might even be up this afternoon. And then we'll pick a winner on next week's show. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This was an amazing conversation. I know my gadget block, the second half of the podcast was a little weaker, but I love the ability to kind of just roll with it, go with the flow, just kind of chat about some other techie things and tech trends. Bring those questions. I wouldn't mind squishing even more of the articles that we cover and getting into more engaged question and answer, Q&A kinds of things. So to go along with that, next week's show is going to be our monthly pajama podcast, where I'm not really going to hit news hard. So if there were other questions that you wanted to ask, or specifics about individual gadgets, or you just want to maybe riff on movies or music, I've been listening to so many new albums and it's awesome and I love it. And my ears have never been happier reviewing new earbuds. We can go on tangents. Next week's show is going to be all tangents, all the time. So tune in next week, Monday morning, pajama podcast, Be there, be square. I love it. So, folks, thanks so much. Everybody, take care. Take care of yourselves. I know this is the community of people that I always have the most faith in being good tech neighbors. But more than anything else right now, we're just getting out of some of the scariest peaks of yet another surge of this crazy pandemic. And it's now is not the right time to take any silly risks or endanger yourself or harm your health. Stay healthy, stay safe. We're getting through this slowly but surely with every phase and every surge and every recovery and understanding this all better. Now's the right time just to keep up the momentum. I mean, it's been a Herculean effort getting this far so far. Stick with it. You got people looking out for you. We've got fun things that we can do online. We've got other activities that we can partake in. You got people that have your back, myself included. So be safe. Take care. I'll catch you all here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be well. Take care. I love you all. Catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.